I know what you're thinking. My stocks and bonds are safe because they have SIPC insurance coverage. Are they really, though? We're going to be looking at that today. Hello, everyone. I am Dr. Chris Martinson of Peak Prosperity, and we are continuing our in-depth coverage that was kicked off by the great work of David Rogers Webb around this idea of the great taking. What are the legal parameters of your ownership of your stocks and bonds? It's not as simple as you think because we now have an indirect ownership model. It has pluses and minuses, pros and cons, and risks that have not been fully disclosed, at least in my world and in my view. So we're going to look at that today. And today we're going to, in particular, take a close look at the SIPC insurance idea. Now, before we go there, let's remember that the way this whole thing has been set up is that you have a security entitlement, and the way this is supposed to work is carried out in this 15C3-3 ruling right here. This is the law, and here's what the law says. This is important. So if your broker is holding an account for you, it says here, according to 15C3-3, and I know it sounds boring, but trust me, the devil is always in the details, and it's time for you to be aware of these details. Time for me to be aware of them. As well, we can read for ourselves what they say here, and it says physical possession or control of securities. When they say physical possession, they don't really mean that anymore. Obviously, it's a book entry, but you have control being the operative word. Does your broker have control over your stocks and bonds? And most importantly, have they done anything to cede that control to somebody else? And here's what they have to do. It's called the customer protection rule. And it's about the reserves and custody of securities. It says a broker or a dealer shall promptly, let's say you buy 1,000 shares of Tesla, they shall promptly obtain and shall thereafter maintain the physical possession or control, the electronic equivalent, of all fully paid securities, which means a cash account. There's two types of accounts you need to know about. Cash accounts, one, or this other thing called they have to maintain excess margin securities carried by the broker or the dealer for the account of customers. So we're going to talk about what excess margin securities means, in just a second. But for now, all you need to know is the law says your broker or dealer has to maintain control of your securities. Now, what happens if your broker goes bankrupt? That's where the SIPC steps in, and it turns out it's not as easy as it might seem at first glance to say, well, if I own my stocks and bonds and they're mine and they're in a segregated account that belongs to me, and regulators have been watching to make sure that my broker dealer has maintained physical control or its electronic equivalent of my securities, then what's the problem? This jamoke can go bankrupt all at once and my securities are still there. It's not quite as simple as that. And that's why we do have this thing called SIPC insurance. So let's understand what the SIPC actually is. Maybe you've heard of it, maybe you haven't, right? SIPC, the Securities Investors Protection Corporation, was the creation of the Securities Investor Protection Act of 1970. You know me, I go straight to the source. Let's start there. This is the act itself, and it is an act to provide greater protection for customers of registered brokers and dealers and members of national securities exchanges. Greater protection, not complete protection, just greater protection. So we're going to look through this, some of the things in this SIPC law. It's really long. It's kind of big. So I didn't go through all of it, but what do we care about? We care about this, that the SIPC advances, which is important, advances for customers' claims. Let's imagine your brokerage goes bankrupt. Oh no, it's frozen. Oh no. You know, what happens next? Well, care from the act, it says, quote, in order to provide for prompt payment and satisfaction of net equity claims, important words there, we'll talk about that in just a minute, of customers of the debtor, that's the brokerage that just went bankrupt, SIPC shall advance to the trustee such monies not to exceed $500,000 for each customer as may be required to pay or otherwise satisfy claims for the amount by which the net equity of each customer exceeds his or her ratable share of customer property. Oops, and there's some exceptions. Except, no exceptions. Just tell me I'm protected, right? But there is one exception that I do want to talk about, which is number two, which is that a customer who holds accounts with a debtor in separate capacities shall be deemed to be a different customer in each of those capacities. So you could have multiple accounts as long as they are separate accounts, meaning not they have to be separate in their capacity, not just they have separate numbers, right? Because if they're individual accounts with different numbers, that all counts as one. So we'll talk about that for a second. But remember, we talked about how you would have a pro rata share of whatever is left over after your brokerage went belly up, right? And that's what they mean here. Says that, you know, you can be satisfied up to $500,000 per SIPC account by the net equity of each customer that exceeds your ratable share of property. That's your pro rata. That means that if, you know, there were 1,000 clients of your brokerage and together they each held a, you know, 1,000 shares of something. And so the brokerage is supposed to hold 1,000,000 shares for all of those customers in a pool, but they don't. They only have 900,000 shares for some reason. Oops. You would get 900 shares along with every other one of those customers because you would get your ratable or your pro rata adjustment for that. So what are these things? What does the SIPC insurance protect? It protects stocks, it protects bonds, treasury securities, money market mutual funds, and certificates of deposit. There, if you have those things in one of your accounts, those could be protected subject to the limits that we just discussed. And what are these separate capacity account types? Well, if you had an individual account, and again, you could have 10 individual accounts, but that counts as one. Or you could have an individual account plus a joint account. So you and your wife could each have, or your husband, depending on who's watching, could each have your individual accounts and you could have one joint account together. So that would be 1.5 million across all three of those. You could have trust accounts. You could have corporate accounts, IRAs. Those are separate capacity accounts, accounts held by executors of estates, accounts held by legal guardians. Okay. So these are separate account types, and these aren't all of them. I think there are other account types, but that gives you a sense of what it means by accounts held in separate capacity. So that's what this means. Number two, the exception is a customer who holds accounts with the debtor, that's the bankrupt brokerage account again, in separate capacities shall be deemed to be a different customer in each of those account capacities. All right, what does it not cover? SIPC does not cover, does not protect against a few things. Losses due to market volatility. So yeah, if your account goes down, tough luck, unless you're a big bank, in which case the government will ride to the rescue, pat you on the head, make you feel better, and give you taxpayer money. But other than that, you're on your own. Losses due to bad investment advice. Yep, on your own there again. Losses due to a security breach, unless the brokerage becomes insolvent. Like, what? So if the security breach just steals most of our stuff, but the brokerage doesn't go insolvent, we're SOL. I'm not clear on what that actually means yet, but this comes straight out of the SIPC area itself. So I don't know what that says on that last point. Note that if the brokerage becomes insolvent due to a hack, the hack itself is irrelevant. The brokerage becomes insolvent and you may, hate this word, may be covered just as you would in any other scenario where a brokerage is forced into liquidation. That's unsatisfying. So we're already starting to find like you're covered, but with an asterisk. Like, what do you mean if it's hacked or I don't know. I'm not super happy with that. As well, SIPC insurance does not cover commodities futures contracts, foreign exchange trades, fixed annuities contracts, investment contracts such as limited partnerships, and also not on this list, but importantly, gold and silver coins. They don't want to cover that. Just securities. That's the Securities Investment Protection Trust. If you had a gold security, like an ETF that's tracking gold, I presume that's covered, and I'm pretty sure it is, but not if you had a gold futures contract, not that. Or the physical metal. So just to point out some of the complexities around that. Now, here is again from SIPC itself. You can see the link down there. Questions about customer protection. So they say, well, you know, what recovery is a brokerage covered entitled to in the event the customer's brokerage firm is placed into liquidation under the Securities Investor Protection Act? And how has that amount of the recovery calculated, right? So remember, Rule 15C3-3 is supposed to be that you're supposed to be 100% your broker is supposed to 100% be holding your securities in an account over here for you, right? If you have a margin account, no, that's not true. But if you have just a cash account, 100% supposed to be held there. But they say here, quote, in the liquidation of a SIPC member brokerage firm under the SIPC, the SIPA, a customer has a claim against a brokerage firm in the amount of the customer's net equity. Told you we'd be getting back to that. A customer's net equity is the value of cash and securities owed by the brokerage firm to the customer minus the amount of any indebtedness the customer owes to the brokerage firm. Okay, so if you owe them anything, they net all that out. What's left? That's your claim, okay? That's your net equity. Net equity is measured on the filing date. That's the date the SIPC firm files an application to have the brokerage firm placed in liquidation. Cash and securities held by the broker-dealer for customers comprise a fund of customer property, which is shared pro rata by customers based on each customer's net equity. So there's a pool of whatever's left over after they go bust. They've netted out your equity position, and then they find out what is your percentage or pro rata share of whatever's left over. That's how this is all written out. For example, if the fund of a customer property consists 90% of what should have been held by the brokerage firm for the customers, then all customers receive 90% of their net equity claims from this fund. In many liquidations, the fund of customer property is not sufficient to satisfy fully every customer's net equity claim. And in that case, this is when the SIPC steps in. It's not that if you had $500,000 in a brokerage and it goes bust, that goes to zero, and now SIPC is going to true you up to $500,000. That's not how it works. It's that all your stuff is supposed to be held for you safely by your brokerage. Your consumer protection machinery is set to do that. And in part two of this for my members, we're going to talk about how that's not always the case, right? Because you should know about these things, right? At any rate, so if you had like $750,000 in that account, the way I'm understanding this, and I hope I've got this right, if you got $500,000 back because that was what was left there, you get that insurance coverage to top you up, right? So that's so it says here, in many liquidations, the fund of customer property is not sufficient to satisfy fully every customer's net equity claim. And so in that case, the SIPC advances its funds of up to $500,000 per customer account type, but not more than $250,000 in cash claims. So cash is less, $500,000, mostly for securities, up to $250,000 in cash. That's the max right there to make up any shortfalls. So your net equity claim, right? If let's say that was, $600,000, but they can only give you $400,000 back for some reason, that $200,000 difference, that's how I read that paragraph right there. And so, as I mentioned, we are going to be going into this in greater detail, and I'm going to be talking about what the actual risks are in this story for my members back at Peak Prosperity. And we're going to have a lot of fun going through that. So be sure to look out for part two. If you're a member, come on over. Now, here's the good news. There have been less and less, fewer and fewer claims to SIPC over the years. Let me make sure I got my laser pointer out. You can see here back in the bad old days of the 70s, they were getting tons and tons of firms going down the tubes, but there haven't been any lately. Part of the reason for that, of course, is that the Federal Reserve now is in the business, it seems, of preventing anything bad from happening. They've been bailing out ever since the great financial crisis. That just kicked off an endless series of bailouts. We had a big wall of liquidity and bailouts, obviously, in 2008 and 9, when the Federal Reserve rammed its balance sheet from $880 billion up to about $2.4 trillion, a full tripling of that bad boy. And then as well, 2011 and in 13, 2016, 15, 16, 2019, there were all these sequential sort of like more and more and more money thrown into the system. And if you're in the financial sphere, I would expect fewer and fewer failures when you have more and more walls of money and liquidity coming out. So, but the good news, there have not been a whole lot of claims against the SIPC, which is good. Now, what if there are too many claims against the SIPC? Are you covered? What happens? What if they can't borrow enough from the public? Remember, I said they could issue notes or bonds or bills or things like that. Well, turns out the SEC, can make loans to the SIPC. And it says, you know, in the event, quote, that the fund is or may reasonably appear to be insufficient for the purposes of this act, the commission is authorized to make loans to the SIPC. That's interesting, so they can make a loan. But also note in yellow down there, it says, if the commission determines that the amount or time for payment of the assessments pursuant to such plan would not satisfactorily provide for the repayment of such loan, it may, by rules and regulations, impose upon the purchasers of equity securities in transactions on national securities exchanges in the OTC markets a transaction fee. So we'll just charge the people who are buying stocks. That's who should pay if we run out of cash. And it would be an amount not exceeding 1/50th of 1%, 1% of the purchase price. But interestingly, no fee shall be imposed on transactions of less than $5,000. So, oh, guess what we're going to have? Incentivized behaviors. If it comes at such a time when they impose this fee, people just structure their purchases to be less than $5,000. That's how it goes. Now, what if they couldn't quite get enough? What if the SEC hasn't got funds? What if they don't have funds? What's the backstop? If SIPC has $3.5 billion and they try and borrow some money, but that's still not enough, then what? Turns out the SEC can issue notes to the Treasury not to exceed $2.5 billion. So the Treasury can, at its discretion, decide to backstop this up to $2.5 billion. So again, laws can be changed in a real emergency. I guess they would just change this language to $25 trillion or whatever they needed to, we hope. But we don't actually know how this would play out. Note here too, in yellow, it says that such notes or other obligations shall bear interest at a rate determined by the Secretary of the Treasury. Today, that would be Janet Yellen, taking into consideration the current average market yield on outstanding stuff out there for the U.S. government. I'll take that into consideration, but the Secretary of the Treasury may reduce the interest rate if he, or now she, determines such reduction to be in the national interest. So they can just make it up as they go along. Wouldn't it be great to live in this world where you could screw your business up totally, lend yourself money at a rate of interest that you could just make up depending on your personal interest? Must be nice, right? Okay, written into the SIPC law itself too, as well, in case anybody is dense or slow like me, exceptions from the stay notwithstanding, which means forget about anything, section 362 of Title 11, which is the bankruptcy code of the United States, forget anything that we might have said there, neither the filing of an application under the subsection A3 here, nor any order or decree obtained by the SIPC from the court, which says, hey, you're taking receivership, have at it, go for it, forget about that. That cannot operate as a stay, meaning to stop any contractual rights of creditors, those senior creditors, to liquidate or terminate or accelerate a securities contract, commodities contract, a forward contract, repos, derivatives. So it's here too to say, you know, the SIPC rides in, takes over a failed brokerage, freezes everything. You can't get your money, but they can't stop these people from getting their funds out. Anybody who wants to liquidate, terminate, or accelerate any sort of a derivatives contract. So again, the derivatives have senior claim in this. Here's how this has been explained to me by a lawyer with very deep experience in these things. And thank you. You know who you are. So we've been having these great conversations. And look, the whole system of what is being talked about within the great taking is this. We used to have what's called direct ownership. You owned your stocks, you owned your bonds, you actually had a physical certificate. That's called direct ownership. It had pros and cons. Some of the pros are, well, you could easily answer who owns this and who has senior claim. I do. Done. Cons, it's kind of expensive, slow, and bulky, and all that other stuff. So we have instead this what's called an indirect ownership model now. In the indirect ownership model, you have a securities entitlement, and your broker has a claim to another intermediary, which has a claim, which ultimately lands usually at CD and Company, CEDE, Seed and Company. And that's the indirect ownership model. Now, the pros of that are, well, now it's all very electronified and we can trade in and out of stocks and we can have Robinhood accounts and we can flip in and out of things. I could buy a stock, sell a stock in the same 1 second window if I had a high frequency trading firm. It enabled all of these fun things. things to happen. Very cost effective, and it also allowed huge explosions in liquidity, which gave us high frequency trading, enormous volumes of trades happening, cycling in and out, hedge funds, all manner of derivatives. It's fun, right? Now, but the problem is it became very opaque and very not transparent about who owed who owe what and where the risks were. And there's all this legal language, and it becomes very dense very quickly. And that's what we've been going through in this whole series, is just understanding that denseness, right? Okay. Now, this is all fun and games until it breaks. And so that's why they wrote stuff like this in here, because what happens when you have all of this complexity is that it might have been that my firm borrowed a bunch of stock short from one of these brokers. I've sold it short. You've bought it long, but you've put it into account where somebody else can borrow it and sell it short again. And they've sold it to somebody who bought it long, because on Wall Street, for every buyer, there's a seller, and for every seller, there's a buyer. And it could be that those same shares that were originally mine have been bought and sold short 10 times, and they're out there, and there's 10 people who think they own the same shares. And well, at some point you have to undo that daisy chain. You got to take that in reverse, right? The problem is that if you can't reverse that chain somewhere along the way, somebody can't accelerate, terminate, or otherwise liquidate their contracts because they are now engaged with a firm that is now insolvent. Well, now all of a sudden you have a big problem on your hands, because this whole daisy chain of buyers and sellers is frozen, and that could create a lot of trouble. So the system works great until it freezes. When it freezes, it breaks and breaks badly. So we now have a system that has to constantly grow, like a shark has to swim in order to not die, right? We have a system that needs to constantly have more money, more rescues, more attention. That's why the Federal Reserve has been bailing everything out all the time. I mentioned 2008, 9, but they did it in 1998 with long-term capital management. They did it in 1994, 5 with a commercial paper market, and they gave us the sweeps programs, which gave us infinite banking because reserve requirements were effectively zeroed out, on and on and on. And this whole thing is getting more and more and more complex. And my view of it today is that nobody knows how the whole thing works, and they're terrified by that uncertainty and that lack of knowing. So instead of finding ways to dial this back and make it safer, they've just added more and more and more complexity and written rules that favor them over you over time. And that's what this whole thing has been about. But don't worry, folks, if it ever gets to a case where there's mass panic in the streets and brokerages are failing and the whole thing's frozen up, SIPC will ride in and make you whole. And just so you know, this is the SIPC team. That's the whole staff right there. There they are. And this is from their annual report. That's it. Those are the people who you are relying on to make sure that your claims get adjudicated promptly and in total. By the way, if you like this kind of reporting, little self-promotion here very quickly. This is my specialty. I'm an information scout. This is just some of the content that I put out in January. I could update it February, March. I have 3 pieces of content coming out per week that are called scouting reports. I also have one of these big reports, and I have an off the cuff. So 5 days a week, we have new content coming out. Typically 150 pieces of exclusive premium content for my subscribers, but really it's only for people who like to know what is going on. As well, we have exclusive webinars. We had a live webinar yesterday for our insiders. There's an older recording of one that happened in January, and as well, lots and lots of recorded interviews and other special webinars. But most importantly, we have the best resilience community on the web. We have such an incredible crew of people discussing all the things you care about, having conversations maybe that you can't have for whatever reasons with your own friends, family, coworkers, neighbors. We're your tribe. Come on by, check us out. It is the best place to be. So a membership at Peak Prosperity will pay itself back for you almost immediately. Now, so the SIPC is sitting there and they have $3.5 billion. Well, how big is the pie? I was trying to answer this one simple question. I had such a hard time. Like, if they have $3.5 billion, what are they insuring? Like, that's what you would want to know, right? If you bought an insurance policy, simple question, how big is this insurance company? How big is their pool against the potential claims they could have, right? Because it would do no good for me to have insured the Scott Key Bridge down there in Baltimore. You know, I'll take your policy premiums, you know, $1 million a year to insure the bridge, and then the bridge goes down. I can't possibly cough up, you know, what, $3 to $5 billion, whatever it's going to cost to fix that. Who knows in this day and age, right? So your insurance policy has to be mapped against what it's insuring. So first question is, well, how big is the pie? We don't know. Households and nonprofit organizations get tucked into one bucket at the Federal Reserve have $118 trillion of financial assets, but not all of those are stocks and bonds. So let's dig in a little deeper. Well, here we could see that just equities at market value levels are around $32 trillion. So $32 trillion against $3 billion is four full orders of magnitude difference, right? Because $3 billion it's almost perfect four orders, right? So $3.5 billion times 1,000, right? That's three orders of magnitude. 10 times 10 times 10 is 1,000. That gets you to 3.5 trillion. And then we have to go one more order of magnitude to get us to 32 trillion, right? Which is this amount. It's okay. All right. In 2019, we know the splits are of the total capitalization of equities that it was kind of split this way, where we saw 34% was actually held by households, and then mutual funds, which are largely held by households, was another 22% of just U.S. equity markets. 2019, old numbers, I get it, but this is the most recent I could find. Then you had foreign investors. I'm not sure how they factor in, whether those are foreign investors here in SIPC protected accounts or not. Don't know. Hard to find that information too. Then you have pensions and government retirement funds. They own equities. I don't believe those are part of the system. But then we had ETFs and hedge funds and business holdings, minor percentages. Don't know, but it gives you a sense of the breakdown that households are probably a little over half of that overall pie. Understood. What we do know from this here, which is somebody added it up and said there are 63 million brokerage accounts in the United States. Like, okay, all right, that's a big number. E-Trade reported having around 7.2 million brokerage accounts. Robinhood, over 18 million brokerage accounts. And so, listen, not all of those accounts are going to be at the SIPC limit of 500,000 on a net basis, you know, potentially facing losses above that. But if you said, well, even if there was 1 million accounts and you had to fund those at $500,000, if that's what happened in this case, if a brokerage with 1 million accounts went down and we had to tap into that SIPC limit of 500,000, well, now you're talking a number that's vastly larger than what they actually have in their kitty, vastly larger than what they could reasonably borrow from the SEC, vastly larger than the $2.5 billion plus $3.5 billion, the $2.5 billion being the limit for treasury borrowing, way bigger than that, right? So just a sense here that, like all insurance, the actual pool of insurance is tiny compared to the potentiality of claims if those claims accumulated and gathered and hit all at once. The actual answer is it's a tiny fraction is what's possible here. Interactive Brokers has about 1.33 million accounts. Direct ownership of stocks with investors with brokerage accounts declined from about 10% in 92 to 2% in 2017. No more direct ownership. They don't have those in brokerage accounts for the most part. This is all indirect ownership, right? And so about 75% of brokerage accounts, they say here, are used for investing in stocks. So that's the universe of what the SIPC insurance is targeted against. So now we have to understand something else. Remember, I told you that we went through B1 before, which is a broker dealer shall promptly obtain and shall thereafter maintain the physical possession or control of all fully paid securities. Those are cash accounts and what's called excess margin securities carried within margin accounts. Excess margin securities are those securities in a margin account that are beyond 140% of what was borrowed. So confusing, I know, it's a little wonky, not necessarily important, except it starts to give us a sense of the scale of what we're really talking about here. So the cash accounts, rule 5 of 15C-3, right? That says if it's in a cash account, you have to hold, by law, the securities firms have to hold those in special accounts 100%. Those have to be held out. Does that always happen? No. I'll talk to some of that in part two of this for my members. We'll get into those details. It's too much for this public piece right now. And as well, they have to hold those excess margin amounts. They have to. Now, the rest of the margin accounts, they don't have to. We'll talk about that because it gives us a sense of the scale. So there's those margin accounts. Those are ones when you have a margin account, you sign a piece of paper when you open your margin account. You may not have noticed it, but it's in there that says, I agree that my securities can be lent and borrowed against and leaned and encumbered and otherwise, because that's part of the deal. In a margin account, you can borrow money to short or long stocks. You can engage in options tradings. There's things you can do in a margin account. Once you do that, all the stuff in that margin account becomes fair game to get tossed into this larger system, in, at least in terms of everything beyond what's called excess margin securities, the stuff that's below that excess threshold, all fair game. Okay. And then we talked about fully paid securities or the cash account. We talked about the margin account. And they say here that in five down there, the term excess margin securities shall mean those securities referred to above in section four there, carried for the account of a customer having a market value in excess of 140% of the total debit balances on the customer's account. So when you run a margin account, you borrow money. That's the debit to your account. So if you said, if I had $1 million and I wanted to fully margin that, right? I could borrow half that amount, half of this next amount of whatever I wanted to buy. So I could take my million and I could borrow the other half of this equation and go to $2 million. I could actually, with $1 million in my margin account, I could buy or short $2 million worth of securities. Does that make sense? At any rate, that borrowing, that represents debt in the system, margin debt. So how much margin debt is in the system? This begins to give us a sense of what needs to be actually contained at what the risks are in the system. And right now, this comes from Advisor Perspectives. That's Doug Short's awesome website tracking this stuff. Two lines on that chart over there. One is the S&P. That's in the light blue and the darker purple. That is margin debt. And we can see here that margin debt's about $750 billion in the system right now. What does that mean? Well, that kind of means that if you wanted to keep, if 140% of that number is the amount that represents marginable margin securities, that gets us up to about, well, so just over $1 trillion. So about $1 trillion, a trillion in the system is part of this free floating, woo, Wild West collateralized system right now that we know about. This is what appears, at least within the FINRA system, and tells us what's FINRA, the financial, this is your financial regulatory agency here. And so we can see, look at this huge increase in debit balances and customer securities margin accounts. This tells us how many billions of dollars are outstanding out there. And as well, there's free credit balances and customer securities margin accounts. So this is what they borrowed, and this is how much free cash they have in that system as well. And these are in customers' cash accounts. So you can see there's, at any one moment in time, snapshot, about 150 billion hanging out, because that's in millions, and 150,000 million is 150 billion. There's about 150 billion in customers' margin accounts in cash. There's about $743 billion in debit balances. That's what they've borrowed. And in cash accounts, there's about $166 billion. Another way to look at it is take those two yellow pieces and ask, well, what's the net? I mean, the margin accounts have borrowed some, but they have cash. Let's net those out. And fortunately, that's something that Lance Roberts does here, and he adds it up. And so that we would call that net credit. And red represents the net credit. You can see sometimes in moments of panic, net credit actually goes positive. So this would be September 2001. This is August of 2008. You can see it's spiking up there. This is when people are taking a lot of risk, when we're down deep in the red. And you can see as they go deeper into the red and borrow and borrow and borrow, they're borrowing against more and more and more rising shares. So if you that all works out, right? You have a margin account. I've borrowed money to go long. Stocks are going up. They go up, it means I can borrow more. The more stocks go up, the more my account balance increases, the more margin debt I can take on, the more I can buy, the more it goes on. And then, oops, it tends to do that in reverse, where you can see some of these sharp plunges where all of a sudden, where stock markets really correct, margin debt corrects as well. But the net current level, there's about $426 billion of borrowing to speculate on rising stock prices. And that is one of the reasons that we have so much frothiness in the markets. You need to have a bubble. You need two things. You need a good story and lots of credit. This represents easy and free credit. In the margin debt business, this is why people want these indirect accounts. This is why all those fancy laws are written. This is why it's so opaque and complicated. And all of that is because this is what people want. They want this. Well, that comes with some benefits, comes with some risks. Those risks, I don't believe, have been fairly understood by people. And we have to talk about that. So if you want to talk about that more, hey, just come on by Peak Prosperity and we will... well, all the information you can't afford to live without. So with that, we will be coming into this, which is part two, which is what are the actual risks? Everybody needs to know about them. But here's the main story. We used to have direct ownership. Now we have indirect ownership. With direct ownership, the laws are clear and ownership is very easy to ascertain. With indirect ownership, it becomes really opaque very quickly. So you know what this side really depends on? This depends on having a legal system that you judge to be fair and equitable and has the capacity to handle a volume of claims and that is going to adjudicate things in an equitable manner. To the extent you no longer believe that to be true because you've seen court cases that have troubled you and you've understood now that in many cases the court systems have been used politically or unfairly or have been churning out questionable, if not deeply suspicious rulings, then you no longer, the indirect ownership model takes on new risks. You need to know about that. It's complicated how you deal with that. That's what we talk about at Peak Prosperity. And we're going to be going through this more and more and more. I've found who I trust to be some of the best experts to help us understand not only what the actual risks are, but what some of our responses can be given those risks. Hey, that's the world we happen to live in. I wish it was otherwise. Remember, it didn't have to be this way. But it is. Oh yeah. Plant a garden. Thanks, everyone. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.